From time to time on our programs, we have delved into famous and infamous biographies to create pictures of the people whose activities, thoughts, and ideas have influenced the societies of their times as well as ours. It is possible, through the diligent work of the historian, to capture the pulse of the times by researching what a given individual accomplished through his very personality. Here, in essence, is the character's very soul coming to life to illustrate traits of personality, achievement, aspiration, and purpose. On various programs, we have attempted to make you an eyewitness to the events in history by portraying the lives of the great and near great, of poets and painters, of generals and liberators, of theologists and tyrants, of scientists and social reformers, of inventors and innovators. With such personalities, we have turned to their words, those spoken and those set to paper, to mold the entire individual as historian has shown him. Yet it is never entirely possible to be 100% accurate with each presentation. And so, to supplement some of our programs concerning these people, we focus on one aspect of their lives, words set to paper, their words, yet words not widely read, because they were words meant for few eyes and few hearts. Here we may search further and perhaps get a sharper view of why they were and why they thought as they did. So let us take but one specific tack, not the overview, not the generalization, but the one insight to some famous people which reveals the soul of man. It is said of all mankind, no one is entirely evil, no one entirely is good. Perhaps this philosophy is true upon this examination. Today's narrative, Love Letters. During Napoleon Bonaparte's and Josephine's tumultuous and tempestuous 13 years of marriage, years in which began in complete adoration of Napoleon's part, climaxed when he personally crowned Josephine his empress. A few letters written early in their marriage by Bonaparte during his Italian campaign. One reveals his inner heart. To a citizeness Bonaparte, in care of citizeness Beauharnais, number 6 Rue Chantrain, Paris. It is written from Nice, March 30th, 1796. Not one day has passed that I have not loved you. Not one night that I have not clasped you in my arms. I have not drunk so much as a cup of tea without cursing the call of glory and ambition which have wrenched me from you, who are my life, my soul. In the midst of military affairs, at the head of my troops, in my inspections of the camps, my adorable Josephine holds undisputed sway over my heart, possesses my mind, engrosses my thoughts. If I travel away from you with the swiftness of the torrent of the River Rhone, it is only in order to see you again the sooner. If in the middle of the night I arise from my bed to work, it is only because I may thus advance by some few hours the moment of the arrival of my beloved. My soul is saddened, my heart enslaved, my imagination frightens me. You love me less, you will find consolation elsewhere. Someday you will cease loving me, then tell me so. I should at least know how I have merited the misfortune. I ask of you neither eternal love nor fidelity. but only truth, utter honesty. The day upon which you should say, I love you less, would be the last day of my love, or the last day of my life. Were my heart so base as to love unrequited, I would gnash it between my teeth. Josephine, remember what I have told you before. Nature created my soul strong and resolute. Yours she wrought out of gossamer and lace. Have you left off loving me? Forgive me, light of my life. My mind must encompass projects vast in scope, but my heart is given over utterly to you, and it is assailed by fears which make me wretched. Adieu. If you love me less, it can only be that you have never loved me. Then I should become indeed an object of pity. Bonaparte. One of the great American writers of all time, in fact, one of the world's greatest and most prolific composers, was Mark Twain, better known as Sam Clemens. And with all the material that Clemens left behind him after he left this world with Halley's Comet, he also left letters. Above all, these letters demonstrate beyond any doubt that Clemens and his wife fell deeply and physically in love with each other. In the beginning, he seemed bolder, but the pair embarked upon this correspondence as shy, reticent people, unaccustomed to avowals of passion. She isn't demonstrative a bit, whoever supposed she would be. Mark wrote Mrs. Fairbanks 2 weeks after Livy accepted him, but she sticks like a good girl and answers every letter just as soon as she has read it, and lectures me. Like smoke, too, but I like it. 2 months later, in writing to Livy on February 17th in 1869, he mentions her prejudice against the name Sam and also the timidity she confessed in using it, quoting from her last letter, "It does not, even now, come quite easily from either tongue or pen, but it is sacred to me and shall soon grow familiar with it. When you say that I understand my own case without another word, I know you love me. And yet I see the peculiar and especial language of this love seems awkward to your unaccustomed tongue. Thank you, Livy." The true perspective of this devotion can be seen only through the arches of the years, their love notes exchanged on birthdays and anniversaries, missives sent and received during the enforced absence of lecture tours, the impatient separations of travel abroad, triumphs and disasters, bankruptcy and grief. About mid-January in the year of 1894, while Livy and the girls were living in France for economy's sake, while Mark labored in New York to disentangle their desperate finances, in his journal he reflected, "Love seems the swiftest, but it is the slowest of all growths. No man or woman really knows what perfect love is until they've been married a quarter of a century." Near the end, 10 years later, we come upon those gay, pathetic billets-doux with which he serenaded her sick room during the months of her mortal illness. At the grave of Eve, Mark Twain's Adam utters her epitaph. Where she was, there was Eden. And so it is that Sam Clemens wrote. Darling, it is 9 o'clock now, and you're aware that there are no kisses for us tonight. I feel more than half sorry I did not go to you, for I have not succeeded in doing the mass of work I have laid out for myself, for sitting up so late last night has kept me stupefied all day. It is the last time I shall be out of bed at midnight, and this night I mean to catch up. I shall be in bed before your dainty little figure is tucked between your sheets this evening. Bless your precious heart. I wish I could see you. I'm afraid this is going to be a pretty long week without a glimpse of my darling. But then I shall put my arms about you next Friday evening and stay till Monday morning. You see, I ought to be at my post at 8 o'clock every morning and fresh, so I would have to return on Saturday night. And that was partly why I put off my visit this week. But Larned says don't bother about it. He'll do the work of both of us from 3 p.m. Friday till Monday noon, whenever I want to go to Elmira, which is equivalent to getting out two editions of the paper alone. He's not a very bad fellow. McWilliams and I went down to the lake after supper and had a row. I needed the exercise. It was good for me once again to speak frankly and candidly to him. Little dearie, little darling, in a few minutes after I shall read a testament lesson and prayed for both of us as usual, I shall be in bed, and I shall dream both before and after I go to sleep of the little flower that has sprung up in the desert beside me and shed its fragrance over my life and made its ways attractive with its beauty and turned its weariness to contentment with its sweet spirit. And I shall bless you, my darling, out of the fullness of a heart that knows your worth beyond the ken of any, even those that have been with you always, and out of the depths of the gratitude that owes to you the knowledge of what light is, where darkness was, and peace where turbulence reigned, and beauty and majesty of love, where a loveless soul sat in its rags before and held out its unheeded hand for charity. Better than all the others, I understand you and appreciate you, for this is the prerogative of love to attain to alone, and therefore better than all others, I can love you, and do love you, and shall love you always, my Livy. Good night, darling, and peaceful slumbers refresh you, and ministering angels attend you. Sam. Love letters from patriots, love letters from poets. And here is a love letter from a president. From President Woodrow Wilson to his wife. My own darling, it seems altogether too good to be true that our bondage to pen and paper is at last at an end. This letter will reach you on Monday, and on Tuesday I shall go to my darling to carry the words of love with which my heart is so full, to consecrate to her my life, that it may be spent in making perfect the fulfillment of all the sweet promises in which our love for each other is so rich. Ah, my sweetheart, I wish that I could show you some of the gladness with which these thoughts fill me, but it is literally unspeakable. It is not translatable to anything but high spirits and a tumultuous throbbing at the heart. I wish that I could put into this letter, my precious, some words of love that would make you treasure it more than you have ever treasured any of my other letters. I feel as if this last love message were in some sort sacred. My deepest, strongest desire in marrying you, darling, is to make you happy, and I would put into this letter some word of love which would seem to your heart a sort of sweet preface to the book of love which we are about to open together, to read new secrets of sympathy and companionship. I would have you catch a glimpse of my purpose for the future, and of the joy which that future contains for me, of the gratitude I feel for your priceless gift of love, and of the infinite love and tenderness which is the gift of my whole heart to you. And think, my sweet one, with what unmixed delight we can look back upon our love for each other in the past. What a sweet preparation we have had for our wedding day. How precious the experience of these months of our engagement has been. I shall not be able to look back over the last 2 years without seeing that whether I deserve it or not, the supreme good fortune was all along meant to be mine. Through the marvelous goodness of God, who gave me a nature which needed above all things just such love and companionship as you alone could give me, and then brought you to me to satisfy that need. And not only to satisfy that need, but also to make me a better man through the gracious influences of your lovely womanhood. It cannot be by chance that brought us together. Surely a man and woman who can love each other as we love must have been born for each other. In finding you, I found not only the woman to whom I could give perfect love, but also the woman whom I had been loving in my imagination for I knew not how many years. How sweet it is to go back in thought to that time of the wonderful discovery. It seems a sort of seal and sanction of the future that you should have come to me as you did, as a verification and justification of all my longings in the past. Goodbye then, sweetheart, till Tuesday. God willing, I should come to claim a part of your welcome then. The next time that I hold you to my heart will be the happiest moment of my life, and the delicious prelude to still happier hours when you will be constantly at my side to tell me of the love that is more than life to me. Darling, once more I pledge you all my love and honor. I love you. With all my heart and all my thoughts and hopes and purposes, I am your own Woodrow. At Prairie du Chien, Lieutenant Jefferson Davis on the staff of Colonel Zachary Taylor had fallen in love with his commander's second daughter, Sarah Knox. Taylor had opposed the match partly because he did not want any of his three daughters to go through the hardships of a soldier's life in the rude military outposts of the 1830s. But despite parental opposition, Davis and Sarah Knox became engaged and proposed to marry eventually, with or without her father's blessing. This letter, confiscated by Private Spillman White of the 33rd Illinois Regiment during federal occupancy, is apparently the only extant letter of Jefferson Davis to his fiancée and first wife. Sarah Knox's letters to Jefferson are lost, though they were once hidden in an attic near Bolton, Mississippi, and taken during the Grant Sherman occupancy of the Mississippi. And so this letter, from Jefferson Davis to Sarah Knox Taylor. It is strange how superstition sometimes affects us, but stranger still what aids chance sometimes bring to support our superstitions. Dreams, my dear Sarah, we will agree, are our weakest thoughts, and yet by my dreams I have been lately almost crazed, for they were of you, and the sleeping imagination painted you not as I felt you, not such as I could live and see you, for you seemed a sacrifice to your parents' desire, the bride of a wretch that your pride and sense equally compelled you to despise. A creature here telling the news of the day in St. Louis said, "You were about to be married to a Dr. McLaren, the poor devil who served with a battalion of Rangers. Possibly you may have seen him." But last night the vision was changed. You were at the house of an uncle in Kentucky. Captain McCree was walking with you. When I met you, he left you and told me of your father and of yourself, almost the same that I have read in your letter tonight. Kind, dear letter. I have kissed it often, and it has driven away mad notions from my brain. Sarah, whatever I may be hereafter, neglected by you, I should have been worse than nothing. And if the few good qualities I possess shall, under your smiles, yield fruit, it shall be yours as the grain is the husbandman's. It has been a source productive of regret with me that our union must separate you from your earliest and best friend. I am prepared to expect all that the intellect and dignified pride brings. The question, as it has occurred to you, is truly startling. Your own answer is the most gratifying to me. It is that which I should have expected from you, for you are the first with whom I ever sought to cast my fortune. So you are the last from whom I would expect desertion. When I wrote to you, I supposed you did not intend soon to return to Kentucky. I approve entirely of your preference to a meeting elsewhere than at Prairie du Chien, and your desire to avoid any embarrassments which might widen the breach made already cannot be greater than my own. That I know, when you would be at St. Louis, I could meet you there. At all events, we will meet in Kentucky. Shall we not soon meet, Sarah, to part no more? Often I long to lay my head upon that breast which beats in unison with my own, to turn from the sickening sights of worldly duplicity and look in those eyes so eloquent of purity and love. Do you remember the heart's ease you gave me? It is as bright as ever. How very gravely you ask, leave to ask me a question. My dear girl, I have no secrets from you. You did have a right to ask me any question without apology. Miss Bullitt did not give me a guard for a watch. But if she had do you suppose I would have given it to Captain McCree? Since I wrote you, we abandoned the position at the Creek Nation and are constructing quarters at Fort Gibson. My lines, like the beggar's day, are dwindling to the shortest span. Write to me immediately, my dear Sarah, my betrothed. No formality between us. Adieu, ma chérie. Très chère amie. Jeff. There have been those who have written love letters that have set them in the form of poetry, such as found in Elizabeth Barrett Browning's Sonnets of the Portuguese. If thou must love me, let it be for naught except for love's sake only. Do not say I love her for her smile, her look, her way of speaking gently, for a trick of thought that falls in well with mine, and certes brought a sense of pleasant ease on such a day. For these things in themselves, beloved, may be changed or changed for thee, and love so wrought. May be unwrought so, neither love me for thine own dear pities, wiping my cheeks dry, a creature might forget to weep, who bore thy comfort long, and lose thy love thereby. But love me for love's sake, that evermore thou mayest love on through love's eternity. ¶¶ Beloved, thou hast brought me many flowers plucked in the garden all the summer through and winter, and it seemed as if they grew in this close room, nor missed the sun and showers. So in the like name of that love of ours, take back these thoughts, which here unfolded too, and which on warm and cold days I withdrew from my heart's ground. Indeed, those beds and bowers be overgrown with bitter weeds and rue, and wait thy weeding. Yet here's Eglantine, here's ivy. Take them, as I used to do, thy flowers, and keep them where they shall not pine. Instruct thine eyes to keep their colors true, and tell thy soul their roots are left in mine. How do I love thee? Let me count the ways. I love thee to the depth and breadth and height my soul can reach, when feeling out of sight for the ends of being an ideal grace. I love thee to the level of every day's most quiet need, by sun and candlelight. I love thee freely as men strive for right. I love thee purely as thy turn from praise. I love thee with a passion put to use in my old griefs and with my childhood's faith. I love thee with a love I seem to lose with my lost saints. I love thee with a breath, smiles, tears of all my life. And if God choose, I shall but love thee better after death. Listening to the visual sounds of Mike Worf. Please press fast forward, let tape expire, turn tape over for part two of Love Letters. Late in the stormy afternoon of March 26th in the year of 1827, Beethoven's eyes closed forever. Not another breath, not a heartbeat more. The next day, his brother Johann met with Bruning, Schindler, and Holst to search through Beethoven's effects for the bank shears he had willed his nephew Carl. The search was long, and on Johann's part, frantic. It was Holst who found the bonds at last in a secret drawer of a cabinet. With them were two miniatures, a testament written in 1802, and a letter in Beethoven's handwriting, a letter with two postscripts. July 6th, morning. My angel, my all, myself, only a few words today, and of course with pencil, with yours. Not till tomorrow will my lodgings be definitely determined upon. What an unworthy waste of time for such things. Why this deep grief? Where necessity speaks, can our love exist except through sacrifices, except through not demanding everything? Can you change it that you are not wholly mine? I not wholly thine, O God, look at beautiful nature and calm your mind about what must be. Love demands everything, and rightly. So it is to me with you, you with me. Only you forget so easily that I must live for me and for you. Were we wholly united, you would feel the pain of it, as little as I. My journey was terrible. I did not arrive here until 4 o'clock yesterday morning. Lacking horses, the postchaise chose another route. But what a terrible one. At the station before the last, I was warned not to travel at night, made fearful of a forest. But that only made me the more eager, and I was wrong. The coach must needs break down on the terrible road, a bottomless mere country road, without such positions as I had with me. I should have stuck on the way. Traveling the usual road hitherward had the same fate with 8 horses as I had with 4. Yet, I got some pleasure out of it, as I always do when I happily overcome something. Now quickly from outer things to the inner. We shall soon, I suppose, see each other. Even today, I cannot communicate to you the observations I have made during the last few days about my life. If our hearts were always close together, I would make none of the kind. My heart is full of many things to say to you. Ah, there are moments when I find that speech is nothing at all. Cheer up. Remain my true, my only treasure, my all, as I am yours. The gods must send us the rest. What for us must be and shall be. Your faithful Ludwig. And another musical genius writes to his wife. He writes from Frankfurt am Main, September 30th, 1790. And so Mozart begins his letter. My love, I shall certainly make something here, but not as much as you and various friends have imagined. As I do not know whether you are in Vienna or Baden, I address this letter again to Hofer. I am as gay as a child at the thought of seeing you again. If people could look into my heart, I should be almost ashamed. It is so cold, ice cold. If you were with me, perhaps I should find more pleasure in people's kind behavior to me. But my heart is so empty. Adieu. On October 3rd, 1790, Mozart writes, I had so determined to write immediately the adagio for the clockmaker, so that my dear wife may have a few ducats in her hand, and I did it, but was unluckily, as it is with most hateful work, unable to complete it. I write every day. If it were for a great clock and the thing sounded like an organ, then I should enjoy it, but the work is for a mere tiny piping, which sounds shrill and childish. I live quite retired here, and don't go out the whole morning, but stick in my hole of a room and write. As I wrote the foregoing page, many tears fell on the paper. But now let me be merry. Prepare yourself. Kisses begin to fly around amazingly. What the devil? I see a crowd of them. I've just caught three. They were delicious. You cannot answer this letter, but you can address me post recent Linz. That is the safest, for I do not know whether I go to Regensburg or not. Adieu, my dearest and best of little wives. Take care of your health, and don't go on foot in town. Write to me how you like our new lodging. Adieu. I kiss thee a million times. And so we have turned to the innermost thoughts of personalities, to their words, though spoken and though set to paper, to mold the entire individual as historians have shown them. Yet it is never entirely possible to be 100% accurate with each presentation. To supplement some of our programs concerning these people, we have focused on one aspect of their lives, their words set to paper. Yet words not widely read because they were words meant for few eyes, words meant for one heart. Here we may search further and perhaps get a sharper view of why they were and why they thought and acted as they did. Some famous people: Bonaparte, Mark Twain, Mozart, Beethoven, Elizabeth Barrett Browning. It is said of all mankind, no one is entirely evil, no one is entirely good. Perhaps this philosophy is true upon our examination with today's program, Love Letters.